Calling to order.
You're all ready to go. Everything's
got work. And I understand you have to leave, so we're going to accommodate you, even though we don't quite have a quorum. If we don't, what we'll do is, I think you have an amendment to your bill, too, is that right?
I do, yes, ma'am.
We'll
sure.
consider that, and if you have to leave, we'll forward anyway and put you in our omnibus, over for our omnibus store if we need to. So, welcome to the committee, and I'd like to go ahead and present your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move, am I able to move this, or do I need you to move it?
I think Representative Lane wants to move this.
So I will move your bill. Can you actually take action without a quorum?
We're gonna
virtually move your bill.
We'll let it.
We'll virtually.
Start discussing it. When we get our quorum, we'll do the formal action.
Very good, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative.
Tell us about it and then
This bill establishes an Alzheimer's working group, Madam Chair and members. We have approaching the state of Minnesota a tsunami that we have not prepared for. And what we have with the baby boomers in particular aging and with all of us living longer is really setting ourselves up for a serious situation in the area of Alzheimer's. We know that by age 65, 1 in 8 people will have Alzheimer's. By the age of 85, it's 1 in 2. So as you look at the baby boomers aging into those years, we see that we've got a very, very serious situation. In addition, you've got the caregivers. This is a disease that affects caregivers as well as the people who carry the disease. And it's a very serious situation. It's going to involve lots and lots of Minnesotans. And so the reason for this working group is to try to coordinate on a state level our approach. How are we going to mobilize to address this issue in terms of our communities, in terms of our healthcare institutions, housing, everything. It's going to impact so much of our society. I would add to, I'm not sure who needs to move the amendment, but why don't we do that first?
Let's go over.
Go through the bill and then do the amendment. Very good.
And does the amendment put it in the order that you'd like the bill to be in?
Yes, it does, Madam
Chair. Let's just go ahead and consider that it's...
We'll explain it with the virtual amendment.
Yes.
Okay, very
good.
The amendment, just to explain, we did sit down with the Board on Aging. Their representatives are here in the audience. I think they'd be glad to answer questions if necessary. But we've now got peace in the valley and a good working relationship established with this amendment between the Board on Aging and the Alzheimer's Association, working in concert. This amendment, by the way, perhaps the most important portion of this is that it removes the need for fiscal note. There will be no cost to the state as a result of this amendment. It basically deletes the Department of Health and inserts the Board on Aging in several places. It deletes reference to law enforcement in favor of what the Minnesota Partnership for Safe Mobility is already doing in the area of dementia and driving issues. It adds 5 individuals, so this working group will now be 5 people instead, or 20 people instead of the 15 originally envisioned. And it adds a psychologist who specializes in dementia care. That's basically what the amendment does. And again, as I mentioned, that removes the need for a fiscal note. The bill itself, again, establishes this working group. The working group meets 4 times and then goes away. So for anybody who might be concerned that we're setting up a new bureaucracy or a new commitment on behalf of the state, we're not. What this will do is put together a very focused work group that will meet 4 times and present a set of recommendations to the state of Minnesota that we'll want to act on, I hope, when that comes forward. The bill lays out the establishment of the working group, the membership of the working group. Duties and recommendations are also listed in the bill. It indicates exactly what the working group is being asked to look at, including trends in the state's Alzheimer's population and service needs, the existing resources, services, and capacity, and needed policies or responses on the part of the state of Minnesota. It does require a report, and it requires the commissioner to do that. Does the amendment change that?
I don't know. I think the report comes from the Board on Aging, that is our commissioner.
I believe that's correct. I believe the amendment removes the need for the commissioner to do that. It's now the Board on Aging that will be required to submit the report. It allows for private funding, which is a nice element of this. We've already got commitments from both of the organizations here today that they will be raising private funds to accomplish this as well. So This is the least we can do, if you will, as the state of Minnesota, to partner with them and kind of make sure this is a statewide coordinated response. And then, as I mentioned, Subdivision 6 deals with the sunset. It requires the working group to sunset upon delivery of the report. And that is the bill, members. I would stand for questions. And I ought to introduce our testifier here this morning,
sure.
Mary Burchard with the Alzheimer's Association, and she can introduce the other testifier.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Burchard.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Gottwald, and members of the committee. By 2030, more than 11 million Americans will have Alzheimer's disease, and today in Minnesota, over nearly 100,000 are already living with the disease. Last year, we estimated that 175,000 caregivers provided $1.6 billion of unpaid care for their loved ones with Alzheimer's disease in Minnesota. We, the baby boomers, are going to create quite a tsunami as we age, and that has the potential to devastate Medicare, Medicaid, long-term care, as well as home and community-based services if we do not address it. Like any major health threat, we need a response plan, yet most states, including Minnesota, have no comprehensive plan for how we're going to deal with the expected doubling of persons with Alzheimer's disease in the future. We know that people with Alzheimer's disease and other dementias are high users of health care and long-term care services. In 2004, total per-person payments from all sources for health and long-term care were three times higher for Medicare beneficiaries over age 65 with Alzheimer's and other dementia than for other beneficiaries in the same age group. People with Alzheimer's disease and other dementias have more than three times as many hospital stays, three times the number of skilled nursing home stays, and three times the home health care visits as other older adults. House File 2036 calls for the creation of this Alzheimer's disease working group to study and make recommendations that could help us confront the economic, human, and financial challenges ahead. We do require an infrastructure that will provide for dementia-capable programs for this growing number of people impacted. The bill provides a mechanism that allows us to examine the range of issues, including health and long-term care systems at all stages of the disease, consideration of a surveillance system that would determine the size and characteristics of this changing demographic, would look at the state's role in health and long-term care, family caregiver support, earlier diagnosis, and treatment interventions. It is the time for Minnesota to address these multiple and complex challenges and significant economic realities that dementia poses to individuals, families, communities, and state governments. Despite these soaring human and financial costs, the federal government has failed to really treat Alzheimer's disease as the crisis it is. We've been fortunate in Minnesota to work with the Board on Aging to pilot several successful initiatives on dementia identification and family memory care. But these pilots are not enough, and they have not been sustainable long-term. We need more partners at the table if we are to find sustainable solutions and serve our families and communities as they struggle with this terrible disease. Each day, we work with families impacted by dementia, helping them plan for a very uncertain future. But we know that if they take critical steps early in the disease process, they can avoid costly interventions, emergency room visits, and difficult decisions for the families later down the road. We are asking Minnesota to do the same, to act now to avoid limited options and costly choices later. It is our hope that the establishment of the Alzheimer's Working Group will address this coming tsunami with thoughtful, integrated, and cost-effective approaches for Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I want to introduce Doug DeSold. Doug is a concerned citizen and a resident of Lakeville, Minnesota, and an advocate for the Alzheimer's Association.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. DeSold.
Thank you. My name's Doug DeSold. I'm from Lakeville, and I'd like to thank you for hearing me on this important issue. I speak to you today as a former nursing home owner, administrator, and fellow Minnesotan about this tsunami that's soon to overwhelm our economy and our healthcare system, both on a national and state level. And I'm here to appeal to you to adopt the Alzheimer's Working Group legislation under consideration. I've just returned from Washington, where I made the same appeal to our national legislators. I also attended the Committee on Aging hearing with Newt, where Newt Gingrich, Sandra Day O'Connor, Bob Carey, and Maria Shriver presented the Alzheimer's Study Group's findings and requested a national effort similar to the state effort being considered here from Minnesota. I strongly urge you to review the hearing testimony where the Alzheimer's Study Group presented these startling facts and conclusions. These may be seen on the Alzheimer Association's website, www.alz.org. We all know that the baby boomer generation is now joining the ranks of the aged, which will leave us with a disproportionately large aged population. But what is less known is that Alzheimer's is striking down our elderly at an alarming rate. In past decades, Alzheimer's was a relatively obscure disease, but currently, Alzheimer's is affecting 1 in 8 Americans over 65 and 1 in 2 over 85. It's expected that 11 million baby boomers will develop this disease. The cost of Alzheimer's care is 3 times that of other similar diseases. This will create a tsunami of healthcare need that we cannot afford on our current path. In terms of money, this will require, and this is going to be a huge number, so I want to emphasize it, $20 trillion over the next 40 years for the Medicare and Medicaid programs on a national level. Minnesota's portion of this Alzheimer's bill will be in the hundreds of billions. I want to emphasize again, we cannot afford to handle this disease within the confines of our current healthcare delivery model, which is why I urge you to adopt this legislation under consideration. Our healthcare and economy will not be the only casualties. Currently, there are no Alzheimer's survivors. This is a progressive disease occurring within a progressively older population. The families are also impacted by the 24/7 care that's often associated with this disease. For every Alzheimer's patient, there are multiple caregivers that have their lives impacted, which often leads to job loss and financial ruin. This, in turn, has a broad negative impact on the larger society. For these reasons, and the reasons presented by the National Forum on Alzheimer's, I urge this committee to adopt this legislation. Thank you for hearing me on this subject.
Thank you, Mr. DeSalvo. Any questions from committee members? Well, I have one comment. I want to thank you all for bringing this forward, Representative. Well, I think it's really an important issue. I doubt there's anybody in this room who isn't impacted on some level. I certainly can speak for myself. I've got a great uncle who I've recently lost. And one of the things that you mentioned I think is really important, and I was trying to quickly read the bill here, but I think the cost to the family in terms of trying in some ways to talk about cost effectiveness would be another thing that I'd like to see in here. I didn't specifically see it, although it may be. So I want to encourage you to the task force, or the working group, I guess is what it's called now, to try to document some of that. Are there any federal stimulus dollars at all that are directions? Recent trip to Washington.
Mm-hmm. Mary was there too. Okay.
There are through the Administration on Aging, there have been some demonstration grants that Minnesota, and we've worked with the Board on Aging, and so there's been some projects where we've looked at various caregiver supports and treatment interventions. But they, on an annual basis, are like $14 million. So very small amount of federal money has really been going out there.
And there isn't anything in the new stimulus?
Not specifically to that.
Yes.
I think we have a quorum, do we? No, one short, Wilson. Let me ask you, Representative, what your preference is. Would you like this bill to travel on its own, or would you just soon have us put it in our omnibus bill?
I would be open to whatever question you think is best, and I'm sure it's not.
Well, I think at the moment, because we don't quite have a form, probably what we'll have to do is, I know you do need to leave. You're welcome to stay around a little bit if you want.
Representative,
can you
send
him to
this?
No, he's not. We're all for our members. Nothing to be here. People, one of the things that's happening, and just remember the audience know too, we're dealing with the deadline, so members are being called to multiple places, and sorry about that. But so if you want, I don't know if you're time frame, I know you need to be at a service.
Fine, I don't want to hold up.
Okay. Well, but why don't we just temporarily set this aside then, and then when we get our phone, take the proper motion, and if you want, we'll just put it in our bill and take it forward. Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. This is about 2026. It's temporarily all over here. It's true. We can just put it in the omnibus, but we do need to take formal action on the.
Could we move it as a separate bill?
Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. If you want, we could. I could move the bill for Representative Gottwald after we get a quorum, if you want.
No problem.
Whatever your wishes are.
That's fine. Either way, it's fine. Okay.
I mean, if you want, I could come back down and get you, but I don't know if it'd be necessary. It sounds like it's non-controversial that we could just. Do you want to move it, Madam Chair? Did you say you'd rather?
I'm temporarily holding it over.
And then at that time, we'll make a motion to. For possible inclusion, is that what you're thinking?
You can do that, or
as opposed to otherwise, would the motion be to move it to the general register?
Is that well? Goes to back to finance.
Well, it with this amendment, it has no fiscal note,
right.
So
it's just the way the process is.
Okay.
That
would be my preference, I guess.
Go separately.
Yeah. If we want to
we'll just temporarily hold it over then. Okay. Thank you very much,
Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Okay, listen, that's how big you have to leave
thank
as well,
you,
so we're
going
to do
next.
Oh, we have a quorum? Yeah. Are we going to have Carlin?
Yeah.
Will you come and take your seat here? Let's just quickly... right there. Because we now have a quorum, and Representative doesn't have it, so go ahead and have a seat, but since we have Representative Gottwald here, let's just take the... Right. House File 2036. Lane is no longer here. I think Representative McNamara wants to move House File 2036. The recommended pass and return to finance. We're going to amend it in a minute, but that's the motion before us. Okay. And Representative McNamara, would you like to move the amendment?
And I believe I could do that all in one motion, Madam Chair. If I move the bill as amended, would that be appropriate?
We didn't adopt the amendment yet.
Okay.
We didn't have a quorum.
Okay.
So, just the amendment.
I'll move the amendment, Madam Chair.
Okay, the amendment is, A1 amendment is before us. We've all heard what it does. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion prevails. And the amendment is adopted. Now, House File 2036 is before us with a motion that it, as amended, be passed and go to the finance, return to the finance. Any discussion? Not. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion prevails. We just passed 2036 and it'll be on its way to the floor in a second. Thank you. Representative Benson.
Thank you and good morning, Madam Chair. I appreciate your allowing me to go forward. As with Representative Gottwald, I also have a funeral I'm hoping to attend today. I'd like to move, if I may, House File 1332.
Representative Benson is moving House File 1532. Everybody have House File 1532?
It's a thin little item, one page.
So, Representative Benson moves House File 1532. Please address your.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you remember, and the members on the committee who served on this committee 2 years ago, this issue came up before, and we had a discussion about the needs for need for the state to increase its support for food shelf programs, food shelf outreach. And since we last passed this bill, the situation has become even more dire than it was then. I just heard some new statistics. 1 out of 10 Americans now, in the latest statistics, which just came out this morning, are now on food stamps. Texas, the state of Texas alone, has 3 million people who are receiving food stamps. We all know about the budgetary problems that the state of Minnesota is facing, and because of that, I have introduced very few bills this session, only two that seek additional funding. One is this one. The other is increased funding for school lunches. Both of these bills are attempting to address an increasing need. And last time we were discussing this issue, Representative Eastland was on the committee. And he and I had a dialogue about whether or not the private sector could not pick up this. And he and I were going to work together to do something, but I must confess that although I did contact him once and he responded, we never followed through. So here I am again. Although I'm not convinced that the organizations that are interested and concerned about these issues have not already done just about everything possible to engage the private sector, and we know that the private sector is an extremely important part of this whole program. So what we are doing is attempting to fill in the gaps that are still existing and growing. I just I will ask my two testifiers to go through the statistics of what's happening here in Minnesota right now and maybe nationally, but I just want to make a general comment. There's much debate politically in our country about those who believe that the issues concerning the concept of liberty is the most important. Others argue, no, it's equality. But if we look at the philosophers, we know the real answer is that there's an overriding concern, and that is one of justice. And justice requires that a basic human right, the most basic human right, I would argue, is food, having sufficient nutrition. And so, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I make no apology this morning for requesting additional funding. I would be prepared as one member of the committee to find resources within our diminished resources to meet this basic human need. It is a positive good for society. So with that brief introduction, I'd like to introduce Ms. Moriarty, who will continue our discussion.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee again.
Madam Chair, wonderful to be back here again. However, I hope that not every year I'm back under these kinds of circumstances. As Representative Benson said, I first of all would like to thank you for your continued interest and commitment to the hunger issue throughout the state of Minnesota. Your work, Representative McFarland, has made the auditing process and some of the resources more available to food shelves, and I thank you for that. The committee's continued work on behalf of hungry people in our state is greatly appreciated. However, we find ourselves in dire circumstances. We have topped in 2008 over 2 million visits to food shelves, and this bill is intended to do two things. It's intended to continue to support the distribution of food through the food support food shelf system in the state with an additional appropriation, and it's intended to do outreach on a local level to people who are potentially eligible for the food support program to help them gain access to the resources that they deserve and that they need. As I said, over 2 million visits, and I think included in your packet, we included our latest report, which was released on Monday, which talked about the 2 million visits to the state, to the food shelf statewide, and the 21% increase in the suburban areas to the food shelves. And speaking of increases, I did, because we are the organization that is the keeper of statistics statewide, I went through the food shelves, and there's a county report that's included in the information that was distributed to you. I went through the counties that those of you serve who sit on this committee, and there is not one county that is under a double-digit increase in any of the counties that those of you serve. Unfortunately, Representative Seller has the distinction of having a county that has a 70% increase in the visits to food shelves in the county that you serve. Aside from that, Representative Morgan also has a 66% increase in visits to food shelves in the counties that you serve, but all the rest of the counties are between 20 to 26% increase, and that's an increase within the last year. So the system was taxed. It was set up as an emergency food system. We have people losing their jobs at a rapid rate, really running through all the resources that they have and finding themselves, people who were once donors, now at the door of food shelves, needing that assistance. The Second Harvest Heartland just completed a report called the Missing Meals Report, and one of the interesting things about that report says this: when you're meeting your hunger needs, 61% of the hunger needs are met through employment by the people who are seeking to resolve their issue. So employment still remains the highest, the most prevalent way that people meet their hunger needs. The second one is public programs. And we are sorely under-enrolled in the state in public programs, and particularly the food support program. We're enrolled at about 69% now. And the second part of our bill seeks to use the Children's Defense Fund Bridge to Benefits tool at the local food shelves so that we can help people who come to the food shelves discover whether they are eligible not just for food support but for other public programs, because we know that those federal dollars brought into our state act as a great economic stimulus. The other thing is that as we move through the state, we see that they're particularly now considering some of the flood issues and other issues. We'll expect to see another jump in the level of participation in the local programs. And speaking to exactly the local programs, I'd like to ask my colleague, Byron Lair, who is with SEEP, to talk about life at a local food shelf and what that looks like currently. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Byron Lair. I'm Executive Director of SEEP, Community Emergency Assistance Program. We operate two food shelves, one in Brooklyn Park and one in Blaine, and I'm going to ask for help passing out these two charts that demonstrate the increase in use of our two food shelves from 2007 through 2008 and the first few months of 2009. I was asked to come here because I'm average. When you look at the numbers on those charts, you're going to say, wow, that's a pretty big increase in food shelf use for a suburban area. But it's average. We have seen no slowdown in the number of people who are coming to us because they cannot feed their families. The monies that were appropriated on a one-time basis last year allowed us to respond to the significant increase that we saw in the fourth quarter. And if you look at the right-hand side of both of those charts, you'll see some pretty dramatic increases in requests for services. As we continue through the first quarter of this year, I can tell you in our Brooklyn Park office, I happen to know the number of families that came in March in addition to the number that came in last year. Last year we saw 300, I think it was 72, I'm doing this from memory. That increased by 184 this past month. New families coming to us for assistance. The lack of food impacts the elderly, it impacts our school-age children, and it impacts our workers. And I strongly encourage you to support this proposal. And thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you.
May I just ask, is there Alexa Fitzsimmons in the room? Yes. If I may, Ms. Fitzsimmons from the Catholic Conference called me, and I suggested that she might show up, and she has a few comments.
Well, thank you, committee. Just introduce yourself, please.
Thank you. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm with the Minnesota Catholic Conference. The Minnesota Catholic Conference represents the dioceses of Crookston, Duluth, St. Cloud, New Ulm, Winona, and the Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis, and is the public policy voice at the Catholic Church in Minnesota. I'm here today to speak in support of House File 1332. This bill will provide needed funding for Minnesota's food shelf programs and food stamp outreach. The moral quality of our community, of our state, can be measured by how our neighbors in need are faring. Nearly 1 million Minnesotans live in households struggling to put food on the table. Last year, hungry Minnesotans missed 125 million meals. 47% of adults and 14% of children who received food from Minnesota's 300 food shelves skipped meals in order to stretch their family's budget. The moral quality of our state can also be measured by how we respond to our sisters and brothers who are in need, those of us who are homeless, sick, unemployed, or hungry. This bill will help our neighbors feed their children, their families, and themselves. Every human person is sacred and has inviolable dignity, value, and worth. Each of us has a right to life and to the material support, the basic needs, required to live a truly human existence. In order to live with dignity, we all must have enough food. The hunger that is hurting the lives of so many of our neighbors throughout Minnesota demands an immediate response, especially in our current economic climate. As Representative Benson stated, this is a justice issue. Because we are all responsible for all, we must address the struggles that our neighbors throughout Minnesota are facing. Hunger diminishes the lives of our sisters and brothers and undermines human life and dignity. Please support House File 1332, and thank you for your time, your leadership, and your courage, especially during these difficult times.
Thank you very much. Any comments or questions from committee members? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and of course I urge acceptance of this bill. And again, I'd just like to emphasize that when we talk about food, we're not talking about an issue in the kind of the general terminology of welfare. We're talking about a basic human right. I would say it is the number one basic human right. And no society can claim itself to be just. It's certainly not the state of Minnesota if members of a society are hungry, including its children. So I urge support of this bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Representative. I see there are a couple questions. I wanted to ask just one myself, too. The federal stimulus package, I believe, is bringing $722,000 to Minnesota. And I'm wondering if you could comment on how that they're calling it the TFAP program.
Madam Chair, the federal stimulus bill brings nutrition resources in the state of Minnesota in the following ways. $175 million will go directly to an increase for participants who are already enrolled in the food support program. So that's a raise, if you use it that way, in the allocation that they already get, 14% to 18%. Then there's an additional amount into the TFAP program, and that is actually pass-through money that pays for the transportation of the commodities to the Six Americas Second Harvest Food Bank throughout the state of Minnesota. So it is administrative and transportation, heavily transportation, to handle the addition. There's two additional sources. One was the stimulus package. The other one was, of course, the passage of the Farm Bill last year. Both of them have ramped up the amount of government assistance that comes through the emergency food program, and those are the commodities programs. But there, that money, that $700,000 in the recovery package, is to pay for the transportation of that food to the food banks. Now, the food banks, several of them in the state of Minnesota, have made that product available at no shared maintenance cost to the food shelves. So that, in other words, it's available, I think, at 3 cents a pound, and we have an expert here from the department who can talk about that. But it's a very well-designed program based on equity, on the numbers of people living in poverty who reside in the areas. That's how it's distributed. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, I'm just very glad that we have those federal stimulus dollars. I think it
absolutely
will help quite a bit, and I just wanted to note that we are tracking that. And there's a question from the representative. And then, both of you had a question or comment?
Yeah, I did, okay. Madam Chair. And actually, Madam Chair, you asked my question, but I do have a follow-up. So the only federal stimulus money that's available for food shelves, I understand there's a bump in the food stamp. And,
right.
And I did sneak a little whisper to Representative Huntley because of his expertise and asked him if he thought there would be any reduction potentially in some visits to the food shelf because the people would have more food stamp money. And the reality, I thought it was a stretch, and he said, yes, it is a stretch. But what my question is there only $700,000, and is that just one-time money available and I understand it's in the transportation and probably related to the diesel fuel and such increases, but is that all, and is that just a one-time money?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it is a one-time, it is to accompany the food, so the money for transportation follows the food, and it is a one, the stimulus package, of course, is until 2011. Is that right? I think the department is answering. 2011. And it is just a one-time boost. For instance, whenever the TFAP program sends food through the state of Minnesota, there always is an additional fund that helps to take care of the transportation. And because of the more food that came through after the Farm Bill, the money that was allocated for transportation, which started in October, was gone by January. So then we have to start finding additional funds to pay for getting that food to the food bank. So,
one quick follow-up, Madam Chair, if I may. So what will the effect of the Farm Bill be on the good things that could happen to our local food shelves? There will be additional commodities, and to what extent will that be?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the TFAP program, the commodity program, is the backbone of the emergency food system in the state. If you go to any food shelf in anywhere, 300 food shelves in the state of Minnesota, the primary source of product is that TFAP product. And there is a great deal more, I'm not sure the percentage-wise, but I know that both the Department of Human Services and our office is very busy stocking the food banks with food that came with, made available through the Farm Bill. There's more food in the system, but it's also accompanied by more people at the door. So I think we're doing a good job because we have a model program in the state of Minnesota and have been recognized for that on a national level of bringing the food in and distributing it to people at low or no cost through the food shelf system, which is primarily run on volunteers throughout the state of Minnesota.
And just one last follow-up. If we could get that information, I understand it may not be here now, but the amount of, I believe they usually talk in pounds.
Right.
If we could know that. And just an FYI, I had a communication from one. I have two food shelves in my district, and one of them talked about, Madam Chair, a tenfold increase. And I can't remember in the number of years, but she equated it that the number of visits have multiplied by 10. And I can't remember, but I think it was like in the last decade or less that they actually have multiplied by 10 their visits to the law. And I understand people are more knowledgeable about them, but this is the time when they're really, really important.
Madam Chair, one of the things that we see, and it's not, I don't think it's anecdotal because it's been reported on such a consistent basis, is that people who had once perhaps visited the food shelf once or twice a year, now visit on a monthly basis. And that's been happening for the last 18 months, even foreshadowing the economic condition that we're in. And I believe that is manifests itself because of increases in transportation, health care costs, and housing. And people just, they visit the food shelf as a way to be able to make it through until the next month, and That certainly was not what the system was set up for, but it unfortunately is how it's used by many families in the state.
I just have a quick question. We started talking about commodities, and it harkens me back to when I was a teenager, and that's quite some time ago, but it was in the early 80s when the government provided kind of raw commodities to people,
right,
like cheese and butter. I remember the cheese in particular. If you,
yeah,
you sliced it thin enough, you could actually get something going. But if it was too thick, you had a problem. But that all being said, the rice, cheese, I think there was peanut butter. You had to add oil to that, by the way. But anyway, are we there? Is that? I imagine that policy changed. Do we still view that? Is that happening now? I'm just unaware. I'm just trying to.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, that is what the TFAP program is. The cheese commodity distributions grew into the TFAP program, and on the back of the study, you'll see a description of the TFAP program that we distributed to you, along with the products that the TFAP program, the most popular products that the TFAP program distributes: ground beef, grape juice, apple juice, these two, peanut butter, apricots, pears, peas, peaches. These are all high quality nutritionally sound products that are distributed through the government program. I think that when we were doing our work for 2 years on the Farm Bill, it was shocking to people to hear that 60% of the Farm Bill really was nutrition programs, the food support or food stamp program and the TFAP program. The Millionaire Farmers is a very small slice of what really the Farm Bill represented. So there, it gives a description of the TFAP program, it gives some of the products, and that program is run through OEO, Department of Human Services, and then Hunger Solutions Minnesota, which I'm the executive director, acts as the neutral organization to distribute the products through the food banks on an equity basis, based on the number of people who are living in poverty in the area, using the census data updated by the American Community Service Act.
So no more cheese, Ms. Moria?
If there is cheese at Sabathity, they could give you a call.
Yeah. Hopefully there still is. I appreciate
it. I think there is cheese.
Delicious food for some folks. I do want to just comment. The peanut butter jar on the front. Are we being very careful to make sure this is peanut butter that isn't contaminated?
Unfortunately, Madam Chair, we've been using this as a logo for about 5 years now, and there really was no peanut butter in there when we took the picture.
I'm not speaking against peanut butter.
But this jar in particular was...
I'm just wondering, are we being careful?
Absolutely. You know, that's one of...
Around this issue of contaminated food or not.
Madam Chair, that is one of the most interesting things, I think, about the food distribution system that we have in this state and around the country. Because we work with the food banks, because we're working with the federal government, and because we're working with large organizations like Feeding America, food safety is a primary concern. And so when there is a recall of a product, because we have these large organizations that are distributing food, we have a way to recall what's gone out into the system. We know what it is, and we have the ability to handle it professionally. And they're monitored on a regular basis to make sure that the food is being stored safely in cold storage and distributed safely. And that extends even further to the food shelves. The state monitors the food shelves. We have a quality program that really looks at the food shelves to assure the fact that the food is being handled safely. And so we all have a responsibility to do that. Because a product may not be as desirable on the marketplace and distributed at a local food shelf does not mean that we shouldn't be as sure that that's a safe food as anywhere else.
Thank you very much. We're going to move that this bill be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, Representative Benson.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I appreciate the time we've had this morning.
Thank you.
Do you feel offended if they stand on the table and tighten that like that?
That motion.
Thanks for coming. Madam Chair. I don't want to offend anybody, but I'm going to stand on the table and tighten this light bulb. It keeps blinking on and off.
We don't get worthless
content. It needs to keep blinking. Like when you see some of those movies in some countries where the guys in the lights can get up and catch each other.
Okay, we are going to have to move along a little bit more quickly. Representative Tyson, I believe you're up next. I'm informed that we're waiting on a completed fiscal note, so where would you like this bill to be moved to?
Madam Chair, there will be a fiscal note that you'll have to include in your budget if you so choose.
Okay, so you're wanting this to lay it over?
Lay it over, okay. Yes.
Okay. File
161
is before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And House Bill 161 does two things, but it relates to the Cooper Sams Volunteer Ambulance Program, and I think, which is basically a pension-like program for our volunteer ambulance personnel. And I think the easiest thing to kind of explain what's happening in the bill is actually to look at the fiscal note. And in particular, page 3 of 4 of the
Preliminary fiscal note.
Preliminary fiscal note, right. And there's a chart there on changes to the fund at the top of page 3. And so this fund has it's a general fund, but it's kind of set aside for this that the EMSRB, the emergency the folks that do emergency response in Minnesota manage that, use to pay out these pension-like payments to volunteer ambulance folks. And there was 11.5 in the fund as of 2.9. We took some of that in the last budget cycle, and that's shown up in that second line there. This year, for the first time, we also have an ongoing appropriation of, I think, $700,000 to pay these amounts out. So there's kind of the corpus of the fund, and then there's a general appropriation that goes to that. This year, for the first time, the fund actually did, the $700,000 didn't cover the full payout of the pension benefits and the administration. So that's what that $60,000 represents, is the overage. What this bill proposes to do is take some of the money from that fund to use on ambulance and emergency response related items. And those items are, the first thing it does is it sets up a pilot program to deal with something that is a significant concern in my community in Richfield and several other communities around, which is we have first responders, basically our fire departments largely, that show up before ambulance to get to medical emergencies or 911 calls, do a lot of the triage in many cases, and sometimes even can avoid having the ambulance have to come because they can deal with the problem, but they don't get reimbursed. Ambulance, you know, if an ambulance comes and drives someone to the hospital, they get reimbursed, but these first responders don't get reimbursed. And we're trying to figure out a way to better support and fund that program. What this pilot program is intended to do is kind of do a reimbursement model in 5 communities around the state and see if it actually, in fact, will save money and can support these programs more effectively. So that's the first appropriation, and I believe that is $250,000 that'll be run through DPS, but it's coming out of, it's in your committee, Madam Chair, because it's coming out of this Cooper Sams fund. The second appropriation is $400,000 to 8 regional emergency medical services programs. These exist today. Each one will get $50,000 to support their work, and this is really important. I mean, these emergency response, especially outside the metro area, are under a great deal of stress these days, and this will just help to support that. And then there's 2 educational pieces. One is for the Comprehensive Advanced Life Support Program, $100,000 to do some additional training for kind of a higher level of response, $25,000 for training related specifically to pediatric emergencies, which is another. We have some successful training going on, but we want to spread that further throughout the state. And that's $200,000. The last $200,000 is a grant to the VA, to the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs. And what this is about is actually a program that has been talked about for a few years, but it's to allow returning vets coming back from the war who do this kind of stuff in the war zones to come back, and their training they get there doesn't necessarily translate 100% to the training requirements they need here and to the kind of response that they have to do here. So this would kind of fast-track returning vets into emergency response careers, and so and that's what that $200,000 is for, to work on that program. So that is what the bill is, Madam Chair. You know, I think one of the concerns is that as we move through this budget and we're looking at taking money, finding money wherever we can, that some this $4.265 million that's remaining in the Cooper Sams Fund, you know, that there's a chance, you know, I guess the point is if that is looked at as a possible source of some more funding for the general fund, that at the very least we make some expenditures on the things it's supposed to be used for, which is emergency response. And these are some very effective and I think quality programs, small investments that will go a long way to retain and make sure that our emergency response and first responders continue as we move continue to be important and effective assets for us in the state.
Can you talk a little bit about that, just the Cooper Sams?
Yes.
Is it in the Department of Public Safety? Where is it
housed? It is in the EMSRB, which I think is in your budget area. So that's where it's housed, exactly.
Okay. Senator Sams refers to some individuals who were...
Senator Sams and...
Roger Cooper.
I don't know if the senator or representative. Yeah, they're the ones that got the thing going.
Legislators.
Yes. And there's a description of it in the fiscal note on the third page of the Cooper Sams Fund, too, if people are interested, down at the bottom there.
Are there any questions, discussions? Representative Fallon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen, it says there's a local fiscal impact. What would that be?
Let's see.
It's checked off on that.
Oh, well, if you look on page 3, local government costs, it's actually showing that it's a positive local impact.
Okay.
Because of these pilot projects, they'd be getting some money to help them with their reimbursement for their fire departments.
Thank you.
So it's a positive cost.
On the how does it deal with the Regional Medical Service Program, the Longevity Award and Incentive Trust? What does that money actually go for?
You're talking about the Cooper Sams specifically, or are you talking about the bill?
In the bill. It's the $400,000.
Yeah, and maybe we should have Mr. McAlpin. I'm going to explain that a little more.
Madam Chair, members, Buck McAlpin, President of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. In Minnesota, we have 8 regional EMS programs, Metro, Rochester, Bemidji, Duluth. They're set up, and they work with the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board. They provide grants are provided to the 8 regions on a competitive basis through the EMSRB to the 8 regional programs. They coordinate ambulance, first responders, defibrillator programs, trauma training, medical training, cardiac research, and things like that with outcomes. And they were about $450,000 probably 8 or 9 years ago, and their money continues to drop. They get about $156,000 every 2 years now out of general fund, and then they get 90% of the $25 seatbelt fine goes to the 8 regional EMS programs, and 10% goes to the Minnesota State Patrol. And obviously seatbelt compliance is up to 87%, so that funding source has dropped for them. And so as this fund has been used to help with the budget last year, $6.2 million was looked at, we wanted to shift some of this funding in case it was eliminated this year to the regional programs that work close with the volunteers and recruitment and retention.
Okay, I understand where the money's coming from, where it's going to, but what is the award and incentive trust provide?
Madam Chair, that's just referring to the Cooper Sams Award. We're actually taking money out of the corpus of that fund that was providing those longevity awards.
So is it a bump in pay or is it just...
Do you want to describe the Cooper Sams?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely, Madam Chair. What the Cooper Sams program is the Ambulance Association developed it, probably 15, 16 years ago, where originally $1 million came out of the Police Pension Overage Fund. And from that fund, it went into this trust fund. Out of that, based off the amount of folks that applied and the service credits that they had, they need 5 service credits to get an award. Over time, the service amounts grew, and the average payout is probably $4,000 after you have 5 service credits, and you hit age 50, you can claim it. It can't be a pension program, because the majority of Minnesota's EMS is non-governmental type services. And so it's an incentive fund. That's also why I think the legislature at times when money stuff looks at this fund to take the money away. One thing nice that did happen last year is Chairman Huntley and Chairwoman Berglund put this program into statute. So what Representative Thiessen talked about, the $700,000 is in the base, and the $447 per service credit amount that pays the volunteers their payout is locked into statute. So they continue to have the program operate as this fund would be dwindled down.
And the way it works then is an individual applies for the award, the $4,000.
Correct, Madam Chair. Through the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board, they manage that.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions, comments? All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I did have a question actually for Mr. McAlpin, I think. And that's just under the medical response portion of the bill, 1.14. I'm worth it on first page. Identify no more than five medical response units. I would just like to hear or have you just address a little bit how they're choosing to, well, how they would choose those units, but also how to address the different issues that arise throughout the state. I know transportation being a very big issue where there's, you know, many vast distances in between, but I'd just like to hear a little bit more about that.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Saylor, we're working in conjunction with the Minnesota Fire Chiefs Association and the regional programs, and the MSRB will help consult on this. Probably two metro, three rural, and absolutely you're right. There's full-time paid departments in the metro, like Richfield, that Representative Thiessen alluded to. There's things that are very interesting we're doing. You know, up till about 4 or 5 years ago, we had a 5% out-of-hospital cardiac arrest survival rate. Now there's some very interesting things we're doing that are going to require more organization of our first responder squad that's moving that number close to 30% in the metro, and we want to help take some of that technology and move it to the outside. Working with the health plans, we know we can show a savings if we reimburse first responder squads. They're a very important part of our EMS delivery system, and that's what we want to try to identify. Ones in rural Minnesota that might do 50 runs are just as important as Richfield that does 2,500 medical type responses. And we want to try to come up with some data that shows outcome data on cardiac arrest survival and certain types of patients that can be impacted by very well trained and equipped first responder squads.
And Madam Chair, just to kind of follow up, make that point specifically, the idea here is we want health plans to start reimbursing first responders like they do ambulances, and that we're trying to collect the data to make sure that happens so that we get some go through the, because it is medical response that they're doing, and but they've been resistant because they don't know that it's going to save them money. We think it will. So that's what we're trying to accomplish here.
Okay, so this will,
with the pilot project,
this will help gather the data and then bring it back.
Yes.
Yeah, nice. Precedent that health plans to start this kind of decision based on efficiency and savings. I just want to have one question that was sparked by Representative Saylor's question. Did you get your? Did you have a follow up? Are the awards that are they distributed throughout the state too? Are those? Do they have a geographical basis, or are they?
The longevity award or the Cooper-Sams awards are throughout the state if they're volunteer response. So if you have a professional, they wouldn't qualify for this. Or if they're governmental, they wouldn't qualify.
Right. But for the volunteers, are they equitably distributed? That's my question.
Madam Chair, absolutely. In statute, a definition of an ambulance volunteer is $6,000 a year of less of paid time. So that's for our training reimbursement, you know, for EMTs and first responders that the MSRB also oversees. So that's the number that we use to decide if you could qualify for the program.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In line 3.16, you talk about implementing a veterans paramedic apprentice program. Is there an apprentice program now for this job, or is this something that is related with a degree program? The reason I bring this up is in higher ed committee there was a bill introduced to align military training to college credits, and I didn't know how that would work with this.
Madam Chair, Representative, the Ambulance Association kicked this off about a year and a half ago now when the, what's the group? They came to us from the Department of Labor and said, trade associations usually run formalized apprenticeship programs. And they had returning military medics that said, is there an apprenticeship program for ambulance folks? And we said, well, no, but we'd be interested in that, especially in rural Minnesota with our staffing issues. So about 90% of them returning has the National Registry EMT card. About 10% of them don't. So if we put them all in an area of high trauma, they'd be really, really good at their job, but they're missing the medical component of that training. And that's what this veterans paramedic funding helps do. And also, we have an active program working now. Is we did get a grant from the Otto Bremer Foundation last year to get this off to the ground. Alina, North Memorial, some of our other larger ambulance services can take them in at the veterans or the vehicle service technician level and walk them all the way up to a job in advanced life support as a paramedic. And that's what the apprenticeship program does. So it actually is functioning today through the state.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm really supportive of this. My husband's a former Navy medic, so I know He would have been great at this.
Mr. Duffy, I was with you until you said they're missing a medical training. I would think that would be what they are bringing.
I might have said that wrong, Madam Chair. That the trauma training they come really good with from being overseas, that the medical stuff, more heart stuff, OB-type stuff, things that they don't see.
Chronic kind of.
Correct. Chronic
it.
Conditions.
Got it.
Items.
Okay. Any other questions? If not, House File 161 is laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank
and we'll be looking for that fiscal note. You can help us get it.
I will follow. Whatever you need me to do.
Okay, it's laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you. So the next report is for the description. Welcome to your committee. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair and members, I would like to move House File 2007. I guess we're 2 years late for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
So would you present your bill?
Yes. This bill is one that is intended to address the needs that we have, I guess, really for continuing efficiency and making better use of the limited funds that we have now as more and more need exists within the homeless community and housing in general. Many of the organizations within our throughout the state, in particular, are working with the continuum of care, and their job is to coordinate and also make best use of monies that are coming in. I won't say a great deal more about this because I know that we're limited in time, and I do have two testifiers, but it just occurs to me so much that at a time when we have more and more increased need for housing services and there's more demand, we want to make sure that any money that we do have and money that's available federally and other places is very well coordinated, and that's what the continuum of care does, and this capacity building will address that. So with that, I will turn it over to Sue Watney.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. I'm Sue Watlow Phillips, Madam Chair, committee members. I've been before this committee before. I'm Executive Director of Elam Transitional Housing, President of Integrated Community Solutions, a board member of the Minnesota, the National Coalition for the Homeless, and also of MICA, the Metro Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing. Elam Transitional Housing supports House File 2007. We are one of the larger providers in the metro area, but we believe very strongly about the importance of helping people stay in their home community. This is not only a capacity building grant. This is about helping people stay home in their community. Because when people are struggling, they need to be close to family and friends. But if there aren't the resources there within their community to access and to have help there, they have to come to a larger regional city or to the metro area, which we see quite often. In the last Wilder study that was done in 2006, we saw about 30% of the population that's experiencing homelessness being in greater Minnesota outside the metro area. Now, that's using a very restrictive definition of homelessness. And that counts folks that are in shelters or in transitional housing or that we can actually count outside. Well, we have a very large state. It's very hard to do that type of counting. And what we really want folks to be doing is providing services and helping people stay in homes, not out there running around counting folks. So I encourage you to support this bill. I have one handout, too, that actually will be talked about a little bit also in House File 2009 later in the agenda. One of the key things to remember with this capacity building grant and helping people to stay home is that we have millions of dollars coming into the state from the federal government through the stimulus bill. Obviously, the homeless prevention and rapid rehousing being just one of many of them of $23.5 million. But if you take a look at what the Minnesota Housing Partnership has put together in regards to the amount of money coming through the different housing programs, over $300 million coming into the state of Minnesota. Now, for us to do well in competing for those dollars and having those dollars in communities throughout the state of Minnesota, we have to have that capacity in greater Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Jennifer Sculler, and I am the coordinator of the Southwest Minnesota Continuum of Care, which on your maps is the 18 pink counties in the corner. So as a continuum of care coordinator, I ask for your support of this bill. Minnesota Housing has funded the 6 multi-county greater Minnesota continuum of care regions at varied levels ranging from 5,000 to 35,000 since 1996. And the results, while the money has been varied, the results coming out of that have also been varied based on the amount of funding and the planning time that we coordinators can put in. As you know, the geographic and professional landscape of greater Minnesota present unique challenges for regional planning efforts. As Sue already mentioned, the size is indeed an obstacle, and just the time and travel to, you know, to get to meetings and to assist local providers in creating new partnerships and meeting other providers that can provide other assistance takes time. And we also try to work with statewide meetings and trainings as well, which can be 2 to 5 hours driving one way for us. On the professional landscape side, the continuum of care coordinators are the only professionals in greater Minnesota whose time is committed to developing regionally coordinated solutions to homelessness. For counties and nonprofits, homelessness is only one of many issues that they look at. For specialized providers like mental health centers, homelessness is only seen in a subpopulation of who they serve. So greater Minnesota, we are the only people that focus these individual efforts of the broad providers and the specialized providers to meet the needs of homeless people in our communities. In terms of my own area, we have seen the same need in terms of numbers of people that are seeking shelter, but our agencies are running out of funds sooner. I have 4 of the 5 emergency shelter providers in my continuum that are out of funds since the end of this past year, and they're waiting until June to get the next amount. So, you know, they're stretching everything they can and asking for private contributions to be able to provide that service. And the other thing that we found in our most recent count is that episodes of homelessness are longer, and we see that as a result of, you know, people, more people seeking assistance and less available funding to do that. So just being able to get out in front and plan for the services is important. I would also like to say that this funding also supports the time-intensive work of addressing systemic causes of homelessness that nobody else in our region really has the time or the expertise to work on, such as institutional discharges to homelessness or housing barriers for individuals with criminal histories. So, you know, pulling together the mental health consortiums together with the housing providers and finding ways to address those systemic issues is one thing that continuum of care coordinators can do that don't require additional resources into those systems, but just better coordination of those systems to meet local needs. So the amount of funding that goes into a continuum of care coordinator is small in terms of the results that can come in federal funding for specific programs, as well as more effective use of local resources. Thank you.
Comments or questions from committee members? I have a question. You're in southwestern Minnesota?
Yes, I am.
And where is that main office located?
Sure. I'm based out of Slayton, which is in Murray County.
Mm-hmm. And how many staff, for example, in your office, in Slayton office?
Well, I work with the Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership, and we're an affordable housing developer. And we have 20 staff in our office. But in terms of the continuum of care, I am the staff.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so the funding that's available for you to help distribute to the folks that have been gone since last fall, I guess, or last winter, this fall?
Right.
And, but you're there now waiting until the money comes from June. In June, are any federal dollars being directed toward the capacity building part of our...
Not through stimulus. No, that is going toward the Family Homelessness Prevention Program and some emergency shelter grants, I believe.
Yeah, we know. I'm just wondering if there was anything that we didn't know about that could be used.
I have not heard of anything.
Representative, thank you, Madam Chair. I enthusiastically support this bill. I've worked on the continuum of cares in the metro region and the Southeast Corridor, and then in St. Louis County, and then they have one in Duluth, I think, as well. And there's some overlap there. It is really the only group that not only kind of puts everybody together to talk about these issues. The systemic stuff, I think, is really important, the reentry aspect of it. The other thing is that a lot of the grants are competitive, and so it allows us to have staff that can kind of put all of the pieces together in order to compete for a lot of the grants that we go after from HUD. So I think that it is money and time well spent to spend it on the capacity building so that we can continue to bring those resources to the state. Excellent.
That was a strong investment. Any other comments or questions? One of the things I'm wondering, are you tracking the kind of data in terms of the lack of services being available to us, is that right? So that we're, is that part of your job?
Okay. Yes.
Any other comments or questions for this bill, Representative McFarland?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Could somebody tell me what the base currently is for this funding?
Madam Chair, Representative, my understanding is zero.
I believe this would be added to the base, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, correct.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. This House File 2807 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the August session. Is Representative Portman back yet?
The next person.
Representative Lane?
Madam Chair, I move House File 2009 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative Lane moves House File 2009 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
And this is for emergency services grants and transitional housing funding. It's to take us where we've been and keep us going in this very important area. And I have some people here that will help us understand both the need and how it does and doesn't come from the stimulus funds from the federal government. So who would like to go first?
Okay. Sure. Welcome to the committee. Just introduce yourself, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning to talk about the importance of transitional housing and emergency shelter in the community. My name is Whit of Programs at Simpson Housing Services in Minneapolis, a nonprofit agency providing shelter, transitional housing, and long-term supportive housing to homeless individuals and families. Simpson Housing Services has provided emergency shelter for single adults and transitional housing services to families for more than 25 years. Across these years, we have only seen the need rising. Just a few years ago, we were turning away 20 to 30 families each week due to lack of space in our transitional housing program. In 2008, we consistently turned away 70 families each week. Last year, we served 98 families with 214 children in our transitional housing programs. With enough resource, we clearly could serve many more families. Families are coming to us in desperation from being evicted from their landlord's foreclosed property, from being the first to be let go from the job, from medical bills that have swamped their tiny boat, from moving from friend to friend to shelter. In 2008, we found that families had moved an average of 3 times in the 12 months prior to their entrance to our program. 25% of the adults had a disability, and the average income for families at entrance to our program was $619 per month, or a little over $7,000 per year. Each day we see people like Madeline, who came to us from a shelter after she and her 2 small children had fled an abusive partner. She had no work history, no friends or family, and spoke little English. We set to work partnering with her to get her back on her feet. She joined ESL classes, learned how to care for her first apartment on her own, and started a work training program. We also helped her to make connections in the community so that she could form circles of support. After 2 years, she left for subsidized housing, was working, and most importantly, had good community support networks to help her weather some of the storms that are sure to come in life. All of us have these support networks that help us through our most trying times. But for some of our most vulnerable, the only support networks are shelter and transitional housing programs. And we know that these programs are essential, especially now. At Simpson, we celebrate that in 2008, 92% of our families maintained stable housing while in the program, and 86% of the families remained in their housing 1 year after they'd left our program. We're happy that 88% of the kids in our program attended school at least 90% of the time, a group that had previously changed schools often and often had poor school attendance. We work hard to raise enough money and gather enough other resources in order to provide safe housing and supports for these families and children, but we cannot do this work without partnership from our state government. We remain committed to doing our part, both financially and programmatically. I am here today to ask you to remain committed to doing your part. It's during these difficult times that we cannot let those that are barely hanging onto the boat be literally left out in the cold. Please continue to provide the necessary support for these programs that offer families and individuals a clear path out of homelessness. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for listening today.
Welcome.
My name is Rick Podvin. I'm from Catholic Charities of St. Cloud, and for the past 19 years, I've managed the transitional housing programs in St. Cloud. I'm also a chair of the local homeless concerns group and also have some ties with some supportive housing projects of Catholic Charities. And so I'm speaking today primarily about transitional housing, but within that context of the statewide network and its position on the continuum of services needed. In a small program like ours, I'm involved directly with case management and social work and also program management and trying to ensure that there's a place for people to go after they leave our program. But the key focus for today is what happens in transitional housing. We're talking about funding for transitional housing, and there's a few key things that I just want you to bring to mind when you hear the word transitional housing and it's tied to funding. I want you to see transitional housing as a resource that really sits at the crossroads of personal responsibility and social compassion. We are able to be there for people because of the taxpayers, because of legislators' visions, generous private donors, foundations, and the financial support of our residents who pay 30% of their income for the housing aspect of the program. Essentially, when people contact us, our first question is, why do you need us? And there's a variety of answers to that question. Before we move on into our next question is what needs to happen so that you won't likely need us in the future. So in terms of why do people need us, some of the basic common denominators there is that we see is a poor start in life. I had a woman in yesterday who at age 12 needed to leave her home, her family, because her mother was a meth addict. She went to live with her grandmother, who was also chemically dependent. And the deeper I tried to dig to find the bottom, there was no bottom. There's absolutely nothing in her history that is represents any kind of a support system moving forward. And in the course of that poor start in life, she has developed some issues of chemical dependency, some mental health issues. She's been involved in domestic violence situations. She has a combination of no credentials and poor credentials moving forward. So, and that is not uncommon. So, we take the next step and say, well, okay, what needs to happen now? And we look at her situation and realize that she has skills, energies, and she is a resource in this process. And we identify that for her and say, this is what you need to do. This is what you can do. And we give her, thanks to the social compassion that we hope will maintain itself out there, as Representative Benson mentioned the word justice earlier, we try to provide at that intersection another very important word in any good society is hope. And she has very little of that. And it's a very fragile flame that we try to feed. And we make promises. I made the promise to her yesterday that if, I said to her face to face, if you do your part, we have a vision and you can get there. And her part is paying her program fee, being a good mother to her one-year-old child, paying 35% of her, or 30% of her income goes to pay the program fee. We also expect her to be paying 45% of her income to a self-sufficiency account so that when it comes time for her to go to a landlord, she can say, I have money. I have saved this money from my meager income. I have climbed a steep hill, and I will be a good renter. So we don't go to landlords and beg and say, please be a Christian, won't you rent to this woman? We tell our clients right face to face, you need to be able to go to a landlord and say, this is why you should rent to me. Not because you're being nice to me, because it's a smart thing to do, because I will be a good renter. I will pay the rent, I will respect the property, I will respect other people, and I'll be profitable for you. So that's one of the continuums that we function on is those partnerships with landlords. We hope that she will do her part, and we think that if she can see that path, that she will. We see a lot of people do that. We see a lot of people choose to be successful in their lives as long as they know it's possible. There are a lot of people out there who question that. And so when I make that promise, I guess the reason I'm here today is to ask for your help so that I can keep those promises moving forward. Thank you.
And I would like one more testifier to discuss how this might fit in with the federal money that's coming.
Madam Chair, committee members, again, I'm Sue Watlow Phillips. The handout that I had provided to you earlier, and then I'm also going to ask folks if they would just hand out this information on Elam. I'm not going to spend much time talking about Elam, other than to say Elam serves over 6,000 people a year in transitioning people back into housing. About 2.5% of our dollars, or $100,000 out of our $2.5 million budget,
comes from the state transitional housing per year. So it's a very small amount, but it leverages incredible amounts of dollars on federal and other state programs and local programs. And why it's so important that we keep the current level of funding and increase the amount of money for transitional housing and for shelter is that we do coordinate and access additional federal and state and local and private resources and faith-based community resources to complement those resources that are coming from the state. So as if you take a look at the handout that I had provided you earlier in the Continuum of Care Capacity Building, I just want to talk briefly about the Homeless Prevention and Rapid Rehousing Program. I know that Ms. Orr has already presented to the committee. I'm sure she gave you excellent information about the program. I want to give you some information from a provider's perspective. We believe the $23.5 million coming into the state of Minnesota through this program is going to be very helpful in preventing people from becoming homeless and assisting people that are at risk or experiencing homelessness right now to move back into housing and to be able to have a housing subsidy for up to 18 months, which is what is allowed under this program. You cannot use these dollars for emergency shelter. So it's imperative in the bill that we're talking about today, House File 2009, that you understand that there are no additional stimulus dollars out of this program, out of the Homeless Prevention and Rapid Rehousing Program, that can be used for shelter. Okay? It can be used for short-term subsidies. It can be used for some motel, up to 30 days of motel stays. So there are some ways that we can coordinate these dollars with existing shelter and transitional housing dollars, hopefully funded at least at the same level that we are in this last biennium and hopefully at the level that we're talking about in House File 2009. So it's very important that as you're thinking about the stimulus dollars coming into the state, it'd be great if we could just say it'll just plop in and fill this hole that we have in this particular program, but they aren't going to fit that easily. So I encourage you as you think through how you're going to fund different programs that you provide as great a flexibility to the Department of Human Services, the Office of Economic Opportunity, in utilizing the federal dollars, utilizing the state dollars that are appropriated to coordinate and maintain at least the existing system that we have, and obviously we believe that we're going to be able to expand and assist more people with the additional federal dollars, our tax dollars, coming back into the state. So I would encourage you to think about the possibility that with the biennial funding that will be provided to the Department of Human Services and Office of Economic Opportunity, that you provide them the flexibility of utilizing those dollars potentially more in the first year, and less in the second year of state dollars, because the stimulus dollars, the homeless prevention and rapid rehousing dollars, will not be available until the second quarter of this first year in the biennium. So we want to make sure that we have resources available July 1, so shelters are staying open and transitional facilities are staying open in the state. Thank you.
That's not the bill. The second quarter begins in the same what month?
The dollars, Madam Chair, the dollars have to be obligated by the local entitlement community, the state or the entitlement communities that you see there, by September 30th of this year.
Well,
I wonder if there's any questions.
Questions or comments from committee members? I did want to just double check, those dollars, homeless prevention and rapid rehousing, will be available for, the language is short-term or medium-term rental assistance. So I assume that, as you were talking about, there is some ability to work with the shelter systems to get people into very short-term. And I'm not sure, we were talking with our staff over at the Department of Human Services about whether or not there might be some way to interpret any of that to include shelter. And you might want to ask, see if they've made any progress in looking at that issue. It sounds like it's not specifically excluded, but the terminology is a little, sounds like it might not be
the first thing they're looking at. It does though include transitional housing and the kinds of assistance, case management, and homelessness prevention that we are familiar with in terms of some of our existing programs. And I believe that's about $10.8 million fund that's coming into Minnesota for the first.
Madam Chair, committee members, the amount of money coming into the state is $23,546,186. Coming to the state of Minnesota is $10,865,236.
Yes.
So it can be used for 30 days of motel stay. And it may be used to help people move out of shelters into permanent housing and provide short-term subsidies or medium-term subsidies. It can be used to move people that are coming to their end of their time in transitional housing to move out of transitional housing and still have a subsidy. So we may be able to move people more quickly out of transitional housing with these dollars by having these dollars provide the subsidies for folks that no longer need the services component.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Watler-Phillips, you may know this, or maybe somebody from the department. So as those subsidies come for folks that are moving out of transitional housing or moving out of shelter into more permanent housing, would they come in the form of a HUD subsidy, so like a shelter plus care or SHP subsidy, or is this kind of a whole new category of rental assistance that is being created?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, this is a new type of rental assistance. The Rapid Rehousing Program, which is modeled after the programs that we have started here in Minnesota, was a demonstration program in the last Notice of Funds Availability, the SuperNOFA from HUD, and there were demonstration projects that were developed around the country, that utilize short-term and medium-term types of rent subsidy called rapid rehousing, basically getting people out of the shelters back into housing, which is the model that we started and you funded since 1984 with transitional housing, was to move people out of shelter back into housing to connect folks up with services. What this does specifically, though, is that it provides short-term rent subsidies, shallow rent subsidies. What we're talking about in Hennepin County is $200, $300, $400, 1, 2, 3 bedrooms, that, so very shallow. And it can provide longer-term rent subsidies for up to 18 months with some supportive services as a part of that.
Madam Chair.
Just to add to that, members of the committee, that in St. Cloud, one of the scenarios that we've been exploring in terms of this new funding is as a bridge to the Bridges program. With the Section 8 list becoming longer and longer, the Bridges housing program targeted to those with mental health issues, which was essentially a shortcut to the Section 8 certificate, that waiting list has gotten so long, and so we're talking about this money could be a bridge to the bridge, kind of. So we're stringing things out. It's unfortunate. We hoped we'd be out of business by now, but that hasn't happened either.
Madam Chair, just one more follow-up. I know we have a lot left. I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, one, do we have the capacity in place in order to get the subsidies on the street if it's a new structure? And then number two, I'm concerned about people losing eligibility for some of our long-term homeless programs if they're housed through this program. I guess I'm worried about the unintended consequences of getting people on short-term, shallow, as you would say, subsidies that then would preclude them from being able to get on some of the longer-term, permanent, or at least longer subsidies that we and HUD have set up for folks that actually need that.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, very good question. And the way that we can move around that is by calling them transitional subsidies. That then allows folks to continue to have eligibility for permanent supportive housing programs and other longer-term subsidy programs. If we call the subsidies permanent housing subsidies, then that would potentially exclude people from those other longer-term subsidies in the future. So how we are, at least in Hennepin County and City of Minneapolis, the providers there, and it's going to be primarily the shelter and transitional providers that are going to be working with the community and utilizing these dollars to expand the work that we're already doing. So it's not creating a whole new network. It's utilizing existing infrastructure within the emergency response system. What we're trying to do is to make sure that however we term the use of these subsidies, that we are continuing to make sure that folks have eligibility for other programs.
Madam Chair, this last question. So I imagine we're working with the department and with HUD to be sure that they're comfortable with that. The MHFA typically is a little more lenient in terms of how we talk about those issues, but I know that HUD has been less lenient, if you will, in terms of looking at how to keep people categorized in a way that they can receive the higher level voucher. So maybe that's more of a comment than a statement. That I just think that drilling, I don't want to drill down too deep here, but you know, we've some of us have done this work before, Wendy, yourself, Sue, and even myself, to really kind of make sure that we're clear that as we're using these subsidies, that we're doing it in a way that doesn't put a person, that doesn't create a cliff for an individual a year from now when the stimulus money runs out, that they're back in the same situation because their situation hasn't improved enough for them to pay themselves, and that we've not disqualified them because of this money. So I just wanted to say,
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, your concerns are well noted, and we are talking with HUD and are talking with the State Departments about those issues.
I appreciate that.
So, Madam Chair, I guess the final comment would be that in order to have this area of our concern covered to some extent and to be able to work with the funds that are coming from the federal government, we do need some money to be able to transition.
Yes, thank you,
Madam Chair. Ms. Watliff-Phillips, I got on this handout you have, it says St. Paul getting about $3.3 million. What about the other municipalities within Ramsey County? Are they under the state program then?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, they are under the state program. Okay. And Madam Chair, Representative, for communities to be eligible, they had to meet a $500,000 threshold. The community, Ramsey County, did not meet that threshold. It's funded to the entitlement communities based on the $1.5 billion and then distributed under the ESG formula, and the rest of Ramsey County did not meet that threshold, and that's why they're under the state.
So you wouldn't have put Ramsey County as one unit or not?
Madam Chair, Representative, this is how the federal government distributed the dollars to entitlement communities.
The discussion. I see Mr. Johnson's in the room, and I'm just wondering if you can indicate, do you have anything to add from our discussion the other day about the use of shelter, the federal dollars for shelter? And you might, I might explain to folks, we're actually, as a state, able to offer some comments to the federal government on how we'd like to see these federal students' dollars use, and it was one of our concerns, and I know you're kind of working on that. Did you report to us on that?
Madam Chair, Chuck Johnson, Department of Human Services. Our current understanding is consistent with what Ms. Watliff-Phillips said. There have been a number of jurisdictions, I understand it, who have asked HUD to be clearer on that question of whether this money can be used for emergency shelters, and we are expecting to get clarification from HUD perhaps as soon as today on that question.
Keep us informed. Thank you. Anything else you want to add that I might not have thought to ask you about what you might have found out?
Madam Chair, just to echo a little bit again of what Ms. Watliff-Phillips said, I think part of what we're trying to do in here that we need to keep in mind is to coordinate what we're doing with the state funds and what the six localities are doing with their funds so that we're ensuring we're getting coverage of wherever there's need across the state and that we're not concentrating dollars all in one place, and also that we're trying to use the dollars in a way that works with current programming to make the best uses we can for homeless folks in Minnesota.
Thank you very much. Okay. So,
I would renew the motion to put House File 2009 into the omnibus bill right over.
Okay, and House File 2009 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. President Kunis, I think you're
Treasurer, Mr. Bill Mayer. And we have to we're passing out the most recent engrossment because the one of the folders is not updated yet, was not updated, so this is the update. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 250 is a bill that's trying to assess, evaluate, and then have some reporting done on toxic chemicals in children's products. And in its response to the public health concerns and environmental concerns that have been expressed by many, including the Federal Government Accountability Office, that our federal EPA has not been doing their job, basically, in protecting the health of Americans in terms of what chemicals are in products and also even assessing the chemicals for toxicity. For example, dioxin has been under assessment by the EPA for 18 years, formaldehyde and trichloroethylene for over a decade, and the last major toxic chemical policy signed into law in this country was signed by Gerald Ford, the Toxic Substances Control Act. And so I think Minnesotans and Minnesota's children in particular deserve better knowledge and better protection than that through better knowledge. And so House File 250 is wanting to address some of those big concerns. And basically a quick run through the bill.
Please make sure we move this bill.
Okay.
I'll move the House File 250 be recommended for passage to the Energy and to the Finance Committee. That's way to several other committees.
No, I think it'll be in Finance Committee. Okay. All right. It's been to several committees.
I know,
Madam Chair.
You can see that. I'm doing a lot of work on this bill.
And so you've got some basic definitions, and then it asks the Department of Health to create a list of chemicals of high concern. These are chemicals that are thought to be carcinogens, reproductive developmental toxins, endocrine disruptors, and or persistent bioaccumulative and toxic, or very persistent or very bioaccumulative. And then it also allows the department to use information and lists created by other states. Maine and Washington are already undergoing a similar sort of process. It then identifies priority chemicals, and these are chemicals that are found, or high production volume chemicals, and found in the human body or in human tissues or fluids, or as well as in the environment or in fish wildlife or in the home environment. And then I'd ask the department to identify safer alternatives to the priority chemicals, and it has level one and level two. Level one being chemicals where there is a safer alternative identified, and level two where we need more information in order to do that. And then we simply ask manufacturers to here we change over to the PCA because we're looking at what agencies do. We ask manufacturers to report back on which of the level one or level two priority chemicals are in the products they're selling. We have some exemptions and applicability, allowing the state to accept donations to do this program. Participation in the Interstate Chemicals Clearinghouse is, again, sort of another shared services idea. Sharing information about different science data, where this stuff is, hazards, that sort of thing, and then asking for a couple reports, one from the Department of Health on how they're doing in creating these lists, and then the PCA and how they're doing in developing the report back, as well as some information about how to reduce the use and phase out priority chemicals in children's products. So I actually have an amendment, Madam Chair.
All right.
And then I have an oral amendment.
Do you have an amendment in a packet?
You should.
Okay.
It's the A8 amendment.
Okay.
Yeah. And
I'll remove that amendment be before us.
And do you want me to explain, or do you want to? It puts it in the form I'd like. It cleans up a lot of it's mostly technical, cleaning up some of the agency and department language, some of the section numbers. And it makes the safer alternative presumption, I think, more clear if you look at how that's done, if it's a chemical is not a chemical of high concern, and it has one of these other criteria underneath, so it makes that more clear, and then it puts another exemption in for outdoor sports equipment. Apparently there's a young woman in Minnesota who's a fantastic motorbiker of some sort, and we've discussed this in several committees, so this exemption, I worked with the retailers to make sure this exemption would cover that. We're not trying to regulate various motorized outdoor sport equipment. And then it also asks, in the report, we add some green chemistry life cycle analysis recommendations to the report the PCA makes.
The amendment is before, so it puts the bill in the order that the author refers. Any discussion? Not all those in favor?
Chair.
Representative Neckman?
It's just a couple technical questions to the drafting of the amendment, if I may.
Okay.
Representative Knute, just wondering, did our fiscal analyst help you draft it? I'm wondering who I should address my questions to.
Representative McNamara, Bob Aliff has been working through the committees with me on this one. I'm not sure if he's here right now. That's who I've been working with to draft the amendment.
If I could, Madam Chair, on page 1, line 18 of the amendment, I'm wondering if I'm trying to follow the end of that after the word exempt and delete with the quotes. I'm thinking that might be a mistake, or am I missing something?
It says here.
If you look at the continuing on to 1.19, I'm the rewording of the section, not the section numbers, but the parts in law, that the delete that quote after is actually quotes around 116.9409, and deleting that and inserting 116.9406. It's just fixing the references. Does that answer your question?
Thank you, Representative Kinnum. That did. And then I have one other one, if I may, Madam Chair. On the deletion of lines 4.22 and 4.33, are we deleting the word concern on line 4.24?
On which line is that on?
It would be line 1.9 of your amendment. It actually, I'm sorry, it would be line, I believe it would be line 1.8 of the AA amendment.
Mm-hmm.
It says to delete, I believe, everything on that line, but what about the word concern on line 4.24? I'm assuming that's getting deleted too. And the semicolon. Madam Chair, Representative.
Madam Chair, what the amendment is doing,
I think Representative Kinney deletes the whole line and leaves one dangling word. I think that's what Representative
Kinney
was pointing out. And so it seems like it might be a technical.
Okay.
Is that the actual case, or is it just deleting the little number one or I? It's only deleting that, what do you call that, a one or an I inside the parentheses. It's not deleting the whole line.
Yeah. That may be.
It deletes the whole line.
You didn't mean to take out the whole line on 4.23 in your bell digits. Is that what? Okay, so that needs to stay in?
Yeah.
Representative McNamara, I think the way it's written is correct.
Oh.
She's just deleting the number, the letter.
Thank you.
Okay.
That's it, Madam Chair.
For the discussion, the amendment is before us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion prevails, and your bill as amended is before us.
Madam Chair, I had one other amendment. I've been talking with the Department of Health. On line 4.3, I simply want to delete line 4.3. What the bill is in this form is trying to do is identify toxic chemicals and then kind of get that down to a smaller universe, and then to the smallest universe of the level 1 and level 2 priority chemicals, and then ask for manufacturers to report back. And so when talking with the Department of Health of how they would implement it, they would have to do a lot of work to figure out what's in children's products, because frankly we don't know. Parents don't have that information. And so we didn't think it was, the point of the bill is not to have the Department of Health do that, then go through this listing and then have the manufacturers do it again. It's to have the manufacturers do it after we go through this listing. And that's, you know, a huge point of the bill is that we don't know what's in the products that we're buying and using with our children. And so I would like, if you could move.
I move on Representative Knuth's bill, the deletion of line 4.3. Any discussion? Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, we just also include renumbering, resequencing the numbers.
And renumber the bill accordingly. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion prevails, and the bill has amended and amended this before us. Any further discussion on the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if we're going to get a chance to hear from the Department of Health and or the Department of Pollution Control in regards to the agency's cost and level of involvement to implement the bill.
Representative or Madam Chair, Representative McMurray, I'm happy to have them talk. I have one testifier. Do you want her to testify or do you want her to answer questions before we do that?
Why don't you testify and then we'll go ahead.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Kathleen Schuler and I work for the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, and I'm also co-director of Healthy Legacy. And Healthy Legacy is a statewide public health coalition with broad membership from the Minnesota Public Health Association to the Minnesota Council of Churches, the State PTA, the Learning Disability Association, the Nurses Association. You've got several letters of support in your informational packet. We're addressing the problem of toxic chemicals in consumer products. And we're focusing first on children because children are most vulnerable to these early life low-dose exposures. This is definitely a public health problem, but it's also an environmental problem. There's a powerful body of science that documents that early life low-dose exposures to toxic chemicals in everyday consumer products can impact children's health, from learning disabilities to reproductive problems and cancer later in life. While this bill helps prevent personal exposures to problem chemicals, it also helps prevent environmental pollution as manufacturers begin to avoid using these chemicals. A 2008 MPCA report on hormone-disrupting chemicals, and a subset of these chemicals disrupt the hormone systems in the human body and especially affect young children. Well, the MPCA noted that while traditional end-of-pipe treatment may be feasible, a broad approach to preventing the release of endocrine-disrupting chemicals into the environment may ultimately have greater impact. So what we're talking about is prevention. We're preventing exposures. When there's safer alternatives, these exposures are unnecessary. And the whole prospect of the bill is not to regulate anything, but to evaluate these chemicals, and if there are safer alternatives, then the department would be reporting back on how they would address the whole problem. And why are we working at this on a state level? The federal government has failed to address this problem. The Toxic Substances Control Act was implemented in 1976, and only 5 chemicals have been regulated. 60,000 chemicals were grandfathered in under TSCA, and only the EPA has required safety testing on only 200. In the meantime, 20,000 new chemicals have been added. So the federal government is failing to protect us. In a recent GAO report, and you've got a copy of some information in the GAO report in your packet, calls for an overhaul of TSCA, and it should be a top priority because of EPA's inadequate process in assessing toxic chemicals. It significantly hampers its ability to protect human health and the environment. So the Toxic Free Kids Act offers a systematic way of generating lists of these problem chemicals and beginning to address this. We're not going to solve all the problems, but if we start with addressing it in children's problems, we can move manufacturers toward a green economy and toward the use of safer chemicals. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions or discussion with the witness or author? Okay. There's been a request to hear from the health department. If the health department is available, or the PCA.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Linda Brummer, Acting Director of the Environmental Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. And the question was for Representative McNamara to talk about the fiscal impact of this bill.
I believe that's what his question was.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, we are working on the fiscal note, and one of the current concerns that Representative Knuth listened to today was my concern about that line on page 4 that we would be set up to be need to create a division of chemical engineering to figure out if certain chemicals were in products. And so just by deleting that line, that has really helped reduce the fiscal impact of this bill. We should have a fiscal note by Monday, at least a preliminary fiscal note. And as you know, I've been at all the hearings. This bill has changed in every committee it's gone through. So we're working on getting the fiscal note, and we've been working on trying to reduce the fiscal impact as we read the bill. So that's about all I can say.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for this committee, because it's before the committee to move it to another committee, and I think the vast majority of us won't see it again. In its current form, do you have an idea of how many people this would impact and what the effect would be on your budget? And are there other services that won't get done now if this bill gets added? Or how many people will you have to hire to meet the goal of the bill? Do you have some clue at this point?
Right now, Madam Chair, as we work through the bill, and as you know, all of my fiscal notes need to be vetted by the Department of Management and Budget and by my own budget officer. But right now we are looking at maybe one FTE, sort of an environmental research scientist, to take on this project, and perhaps some IT work on the web. But again, that's my opinion, and my best guess at this point.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I can do one more follow-up. In the bill, it talks about working on a risk-based approach to the chemicals, but it doesn't deal with the acute or chronic exposure. And I'm wondering, Representative Knuth, are you going to take into account the level of exposure? I mean, oftentimes, different chemicals at a certain level are deemed to be safe, but at other levels are very more at causing trouble and risk for folks. Is that going to be taken into account, the level?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, you've hit the head of why our chemical policy hasn't been working particularly well for us for several decades. We had a scientist in speaking at our environment and as well as our health policy committees talking about, you know, the assumptions made that traditional chemical exposure science is said you take, this is where we don't see an impact in animals, and so we have that for humans, we have that for children, we have that for, and I don't know if it's having or 10%, we have that just because we're not sure. But when you're looking at some of these, particularly endocrine disrupting and hormone and reproductive toxins, and you look particularly at early life exposures, the science on BPA, for example, a one part per billion exposure to mice at birth leads to, and then they have same activity levels, same food levels, et cetera, leads to significant obesity in those exposures. And you do one part per million exposure, and you actually have severe underweight problems. Where we see this in humans more, an example is when you look at the drug used for breast cancer. Doctors have to be very careful that they use it at the level they're supposed to, because there's sort of a peak of the impact it has, and then if you take less than that, you actually, instead of reducing the cancer, you're actually promoting the growth of the cancer cells. So the dosages, the sort of chronic exposure over time or the versus acute exposure, these are chemicals that have impacts at very low
low dosages, and it doesn't really fit into the way that we've done chemical policy in this country. And I think, frankly, we need to do a different kind of chemical policy. And my bill is drafted in a way that reflects that. It reflects more of a source reduction, hazard-based approach. And I think that's the way we need to go, and that's a big reason I'm working on this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the flexibility to keep going. Representative Knut, if I understand your answer correct, you're saying you're not going to use the science we have. You're going to use if the chemical is present or not is the determination of whether it's a risk or not. And I'm just trying to follow that. So you're saying you're not going to take into account the level of that the chemical is in the product or what it is. It just, if it is there and if it's deemed to be a risk at a certain level, it doesn't matter if that level is what is in the product or in the food or whatever it is. And so I'm trying to understand that. Why wouldn't we want to use the science if we have science to tell us? Then wouldn't we be able to concentrate where the risks are? It seems like we might be shooting too broad.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, to be clear, what we're doing with this bill is figuring out which chemicals are toxic, then figuring out which ones are in the environment in humans in our high production volume. Then we take a subset of those and look for safer alternatives. And then we simply ask companies whether or not this product is present in their product and ask them to report that. And there's also some supplemental information regarding the potential harm to human health, likelihood that the chemical will be released into the environment, assessment, cost, feasibility of alternatives to the priority chemical use. So there is a philosophical difference. I'm not trying to get around that, but I do think this is actually protects children as well as reduces toxic chemicals generally. But we're not asking phase out. We're not asking how to use it in certain ways or not use it in certain ways. We're simply asking for a listing, and then so we get more information so our parents can make better choices about whether or not a chemical is in a product. And I think that's important and useful for parents. They shouldn't have to do a research project to figure out what's safe to buy for their children, and they have enough going on. I just had a friend had a baby a couple weeks ago, and she can't think about much of anything rather than sleeping and feeding the baby, from what I can tell. So we want to make sure they have the greatest tools they can have to make the right choices, and that's what I'm trying to do with the bill and the form it's in.
Any further discussion? The last one, Madam Chair. Representative Knut, I know similar legislation has been passed in three states, Maine, California, and Washington, but only recently, I believe, in 2008. Is there any update yet or any information that you've been able to use the information from those three states to help you?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, we've been... And Kathleen has been in contact with them. She could probably speak on it more clearly, but that's right. Part of the reason we put using the lists from other states, so our own departments can use some of the work they've done and be in contact with them as we make our own decisions about the listing of these chemicals. I think that's where we'll get a lot of that oversight shared services, since it's good for us in Wisconsin. I think we can try to learn and maybe just take some of the work that Maine and Washington have done as well.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative McNamara. Maine and Washington have a similar framework, and they've come up with the second priority list between 50 and 80 chemicals that are in children's products that are also found in the human body and the environment. Those haven't been published, but they will be published, and definitely our state agencies can utilize those lists if they choose to.
Madam Chair, and just looking at
how, you know, the level of concern that people have every time some new concern comes up about a chemical or a pesticide, and wanting to just follow up on that, and maybe you maybe know some of these issues, or maybe some of your testifiers. But I would just be curious, you know, if we look back, for instance, I'll just bring up DDT. At the time when people first started saying there was something wrong with DDT, there was just this hue and cry, no, it's not, it's fine. And now there probably aren't a lot of people that would argue that it's a good thing. I'm just wondering if you have any sort of a list or can add to that. Is there some sort of a trend of things that were at one point in time deemed fine and wonderful and maybe now aren't so fine and wonderful? I'm just wondering if you have some list of that, like DDT and moving beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Saylor, we're trying to do that sort of thing with this bill. So we're not doing this chemical by chemical coming in front of the legislature. Although that may, the legislative agenda of Healthy Legacy might be more difficult if we start doing this as an overall approach. But trying to figure out where this, I think, is a good start, and we'll continue to work on this issue. I think it's not going to go away. There's just way too many chemicals and way too much concern about the impacts. There was just a report of jet fuel being in infant formula. And parents are just deluged of information, and we're trying to get some better information from a source that they would trust, their state government. And that's a big part of what we're trying to do with this bill.
Any further discussion? Testimony from the audience or committee members? If not, the bill is before us. Specifically as amended to be referred, recommended pass as amended and returned to the Committee of Finance. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
Motion prevails. And House Bill 250 is on the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you. This is an important, you've been very patient. Move your up next.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think that the committee has been patient with me as well. I think I was probably supposed to be earlier on the agenda, but I was getting raked over the coals in Representative Lynchewski's committee.
We'll try to treat you well in here.
Madam Chair, I hope one of my friends will move House File 1987 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee.
I'll move that. Representative Lane moves House File 1987 be recommended to pass and returned to Senate.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the reason for that recommendation, rather than encouraging you to lay it over, is, of course, there's a tax issue. And as I'm sure you're aware, given our deficit situation and our tax chair's opinion on tax credits, it would be difficult to get anything funded this year. But what I wanted to do is present to the committee House File 1987. What it is a bill that would set up an employee benefit program for first-time home buyers, similar to what we have in our 401ks, where the employer can make a contribution and the employee can make a contribution for the purpose of incentivizing people to put money away for their retirement, and so that we have sustainable income in our older age. We also have a problem in the housing market where first-time home buyers, the biggest hurdle for a new home buyer getting into a home is coming up with that down payment. And I was a legal aid lawyer for years before I went into private practice, and most of my clients, their rent was as high as a mortgage payment, but the thing that was between them and living in a house was the inability to save up for a down payment. So my constituent, Jerry Moskowitz, wrote me an email and suggested that we put together this type of a program to put in place a structure where people could have this mechanism to save for buying a home. And Madam Chair, if it's all right with the committee, I'd like to introduce Jerry Moskowitz and let him explain the idea since it's his idea.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Moskowitz.
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me. The whole idea behind the bill is to provide an incentive, make it easy for people to get in something that would be a win-win situation. So I guess in my scenario, the way I present it is a person goes, applies for a job, and that job, we'll use Target as an example, offers a home buyer savings plan. It works very much like a 401k plan. The person can go ahead, they can do a deduction, just like a 401k, they're asked if they'd like to enter into this. The employer has the flexibility to do a match to whatever degree they want. It's not a mandatory of an employer, but obviously we'd like to see more of them do it. the benefit is to that employee, this is a person who maybe isn't going to be able to save enough money. They just get enough to get by. But having some sort of a matching right off the bat where their money's getting deducted, $25, $50, whatever they can afford, doing some sort of a match is making it easier for when the time comes for them to have this money saved. It's an employer and employee working together. To an employee, I think there's a huge benefit. He's happy with the company. This company is helping him get into a house that he may not have gotten into otherwise. For the employer, for the employer, there's the benefit that a happy employee probably is going to mean less turnover. And what we're looking for, too, is for the taxes, pre-tax, to be tax deductible for both the employer and employee who partake in this program, as long as it is used for housing or for the closing costs. I think this is a way of, to me, getting a healthy growth in the housing. It's not a no-down payment. It's nothing like that. It's people working together. You have all the same restrictions that you would on a standard type loan. It's just that we're using these funds to create that down payment and closing costs. And also in here, you're educating the buyer during this process on what's involved. The goal is to get people into the house, but also obviously to keep them in the houses. And I think that this is a solid program with no downside.
Madam Chair, I would just add, when I did some research on the idea after I got Mr. Moskowitz's email, other jurisdictions have done those in Illinois, North Carolina, Hawaii, and what it was primarily used for was during the boom times when employers were having a hard time keeping talented employees, and they found that if they had a home buyer savings program at the company that encouraged employees to buy houses near the company. Bank of America actually used it in Illinois to try to get their employees to live close enough to the company that they didn't have to commute for like an hour and a half every day. What it did is it encouraged retention of the jobs. Senator Hillary Clinton had introduced a bill in the U.S. Senate, I think, right before she got into the presidential race. So I don't know where this issue is nationally, but the same idea was proposed at the national level. And so to me, it seemed to make sense to put a bill in and to start getting people talking about this idea. Again, because of the deficit, I know we're not going to likely find the money in the tax committee to fund the program, but I wanted to give Mr. Moskowitz's idea a chance to get some proponents and some allies so that maybe at some point in the future we could move the idea forward.
Any you have questions? I do have one. Oh, Mr. Morgan, go ahead.
I just wanted to make sure. You said at the beginning it's like a 401k, so there is an opportunity for an employer match to an employee's contribution, just like a regular savings account, retirement savings plan. Thank you.
And that there would be a tax advantage to doing it. The legislation gives them, the employer, the ability to do that tax-free.
Maybe that answers my question. I was going to say, are you familiar with the Family Invest the FAME program, Family Assets Investment Way? I don't know what the N stands for anymore, but there's actually a bill to introduce that actually current government funding and I both worked on. And it does allow the saving for homes for three or four different purposes. Three, I believe. One is to purchase a home. One is to come into college. Another one is to start a business. Maybe it's three. And it can be matched by the employer, matched by private philanthropy, and the individual themselves puts in a certain amount of money. And I'm just wondering, have you checked that out? Because this is very similar to that, except the other one allows more matching. And is a difference the fact that this would be tax deductible if you're able to get that set up? Or I think in the other one, the tax deductibility would go to the philanthropic source, but it just sounds like the business would also be able to.
Madam Chair, yes, this is modeled more on the traditional 401k, and I think you and I probably met about this idea maybe a year or two ago, and I learned as much as I could about those accounts, but the idea of having it as a sort of a tax preferred thing where an employer could not have to pay taxes, and the employee not have to pay taxes on that, sort of put it in a different category, more like a cafeteria plan.
Okay, so from here, this will be going to the finance. Okay, and not to tax me, because that part is money.
No. Then I think maybe the
I don't know if the Finance Committee refers to taxes.
They could, yeah. Okay, so you're not taking it through.
Okay, any further discussion?
Madam Chair, just so that the realtors are here, I wonder if they had a quick word of comment.
I didn't recognize that.
Word of comment, I would.
Sure, you're certainly welcome to the committee.
Thanks, Liz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Christine Berger with the Minnesota Association of Realtors, and we haven't taken an official position on this, but it seems like it would be a great idea. So, we obviously haven't run it through the mill yet. We just the bill was introduced in between the last time we had our conference call and now. So, but yeah, we've talked to Jerry about this, and Representative Hartman's been great to talk about this issue. So, looking forward to working with both of them on this issue.
Further discussion? Not that House File 1987 is before us to be referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion to be there. And the bill's on the way.
Thank you.
Okay, we have the minutes from our last April 1st. Any discussion about those minutes? If not, motion before us to approve those minutes. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
No? Motion fails and minutes are approved. And not. Committee members, we meet Tuesday, is that right? For beginning looking at our bill. Interesting day, so please come prepare to spend more time thinking about the bill.
So we're going to be, Madam Chair, if I may, so we're going to begin to work on our bill on Tuesday.
It's actually public testimony and discussion by committee, and then the markup is in the next week. We'll be coming back, so you get a little time to think about it over the break. But on Tuesday, we'll have the public testimony. You have the bill. You'll have the bill. You can comment on it, work it over, start talking about it with your constituents and colleagues.
Well, and I just want to say, Madam Chair, thank you for being so open in giving this up to us and such, and being understanding of sometimes our long questioning. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Want to make sure we have a good bill coming out here. Thank you. Okay, all those in favor of the journey, come say aye. Vote.
Oh my God, we are adjourned. I never thought I'd take a vote on that.